The following program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. Movies and media are changing the way we think, live, relate, and dream. So each week, we talk to media pioneers and also showcase today's independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is a metaphor for the movie's magical power to transform our lives.
Well, today we have a very daring, thought-provoking, and very timely documentary by award-winning filmmaker Philippe Diaz. It's called The End of Poverty, and it's released by Cinema Libre. And we have with us on the line the producer of the film. We're going to have Philippe in just a little bit, Beth Portillo. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Randall. Thank you for having us on today.
Well, you're very welcome. I've been really taken with this movie after watching it over the past week. What it does is it poses the question to all of us, which is why in a world with so much wealth do we still have so much poverty where billions of people live on less than $1 a day? And it's a question that really needs to be asked today. And as I wrote on my site, spiritoffilm.net, if everyone wants to truly understand what the word sustainability means, actually really means, and its global and personal implications, then The End of Poverty is the movie that you want to see. Thanks for getting this film made, because I think it'll do a great service to our future and to our future generations. So talk a little bit about how the film kind of got launched with Philippe and yourself and Cinema Libre.
Sure. As you know, our company, Cinema Libre Studio, is an independent production distribution company here in L.A. that focuses on social issue films because we believe movies should make a difference. About 3 years ago, we were actually called out of the blue by a nonprofit foundation, the Robert Schockenbach Foundation in New York, and one of their board members, a young gentleman by the name of Matt Stillman, called and said, "How would you like to do a film on poverty?" They'd seen another one of our films that we had distributed. We said, well, you know, that's sort of right in our sweet spot. And so from that, we developed the film, which is now currently in its theatrical release in the United States. Philippe directed the film, and he's also the founder of Cinema Libre Studio. And we've been putting films out into the marketplace that help open eyes and minds about the true issues that are going on that you often don't see in the mainstream media. So we thank you, Randall, for shining the light on these issues as well. As I mentioned, the film's currently in theatrical release, so the people who are listening in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Irvine, Seattle, and Portland can currently find the film in theaters, and of course there's a listing on our website at theendofpoverty.com, and we hope that you can check it out there so that you can hear, see for yourself what Randall's saying about the true reasons for, you know, the true meaning of sustainability and what the difference is between the resource consumption between North and South of the planet.
Well, the documentary really looks at a global story, and it's told through the eyes of many incredible speakers, economists who you've interviewed. One of my favorites, actually, old friend of mine, John Perkins, who wrote the best-selling book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is in the film, and he said some amazing things, which I'm going to talk a little bit about with Philippe later. It was especially about the story of Iraq. That really kind of got me. So that's a little teaser. The speakers who are in the movie were from all different disciplines in terms of their look at poverty from economic, from trade, from many different areas. But they all kind of had a part of this story which the film tells, which really looks at this whole idea of how did we get to where we're at today with the global situation. And it really begins 500 years ago in the age of colonialism, and colonialism first began with the arrival of, you know, Columbus in the New World and everything. And I never looked at it from this aspect of the modern day global economic situation and poverty itself from that perspective before. And when the film started on that foot, I started to realize that, yeah, this is really a situation that has that was started a long time ago, that we're in the sort of final stages of this system that has been perpetuating for 500 years, and now the system has perpetuated to the point where we're actually destroying the planet in order to sustain it.
And it's very interesting, too, in that in terms of, you know, when we show the film to various audiences, people who come from the global south, you know, Latin America or Africa, or, you know, one of the countries that was colonized, they immediately and intuitively understand this film. And what is, when they're nodding their head right out of the gate, and, you know, because they've lived it, you know, they understand, you know, they know that they're behind, and it's been, they're still feeling the vestiges of colonialization, even today. And versus us in the north, you know, those of us who even though we maybe have studied the issues for decades or years, you know, you see people like yourself saying, wow, I never really connected it all the way from colonial times to modern times. So it makes for a very interesting conversation, you know, a lot of eye-opening for the people. And I think the other thing we get a lot of praise for is that we do let the people living in poverty, many people who are living in poverty, speak for themselves. And I traveled with Philippe, obviously, when we were shooting the film. And what I learned, you know, as an American, you know, educated in the American school system, and given the media, given the information that, you know, we receive, what I learned is that most people living in the global south know what globalization means far better than your top educated Americans. You know, are able to explain it and break it down and personalize it, you know, in very direct and meaningful ways, whereas for most of us it's just sort of this concept of, you know, good business or however you want to, you know, however we perceive it. But our lack of education becomes very evident, you know, of what our economic policies are globally until you see people who are affected by them.
Well, one of the things that really struck me when you were traveling with Philippe, you actually really got into the intimate lives of some of these people who are in this situation, a Venezuelan farmer, people in Kenya harvesting tea and just trying to feed their children, and you talked about mines in Bolivia. And I was just really taken because Philippe was able to capture the intelligence and the noble attitudes of all these people who are living in poverty and fighting for their human rights in order to exist and have some sort of a life. Some of them, they talk not from a point of suffering, but from a point of just trying to exist and have a life and take care of their families and build their community. You really captured the spirit and the heart of all these people who you spoke with. Although the film is a lot of interviews, you talk about each of the countries and each of the areas one at a time, so people can really begin to grasp the situation that's happening just and the story of what's happening in that area. One of the extremely telling story was from the miners in Bolivia. He said himself that they pulled so much silver out of this mine that you could build a bridge from Bolivia to Spain. I mean, that's a lot of silver. I mean, that was just an amazing comment by him. And then they were venerating the spirits of the miners who had died mining hundreds of years ago. Well, I think we've got Philippe on the line there. Philippe, are you with us?
Yes, absolutely. How are you? Sorry for the delay. You know, the traffic in Paris is no better than in Los Angeles or New York.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Beth and I have been having a very nice discussion. Thanks for joining us today and talking about your film and the stories of the people, the lives that you captured on film and from all over the world. So
right. Yeah, the main issue, as you saw in the film that we try to show, is that unfortunately we built a system which that we are totally entrapped now by, because, you know, today our economy cannot function without the resources of the South. You know, like today, for example, the countries of the South unite and say, we will not give you any more access to our resources, our economies collapse immediately. America, Europe, Japan, Korea, etc. You know, and that's the system we're in. And the worst part is that, as an expert says in the film, you know, we are consuming 30% more than what the planet can regenerate, which means that simply that for us to maintain our great lifestyles in the North and our level of waste and our level of consumption, we have to plunge more and more people in the countries of the South below the poverty line. You know, so at the last card of the film says that 18,000 children die every day from poverty-related causes, and that was already a year ago. Now we are at 20,000 children, and next year we'll be at 25,000 children. You know, and it will go worse and worse because, again, we cannot function without these resources. And we are, and unfortunately, we went way over what the planet can regenerate.
The story starts about 500 years ago about the whole idea of this colonization of the New World and this aspect of how land was confiscated and appropriated by the colonizers in Asia and Africa, either by force or by imposing taxes that the people couldn't pay. And even 500 years later, dozens of years after the independence of some of these countries in modern day, these people are still, they still don't have their lands back, and they're still in the hands of landowners and transnational corporations who seem to be perpetuating the system in order to keep our modern day conveniences going all over the world. As a viewer and as a human being, I not only felt my heart go out to these people, but I really started to realize, just like you talk about in the film and the economists and people who are in the movie, that we all have to be responsible for the situation together, every single human being on this planet.
And it's not just for land, of course. It's for all kind of resources. You know, unfortunately, our ancestors built this system, you know, based on the resources of the South. You know, it doesn't matter if it's land to grow food for export. It's, of course, all the mineral resources, all the timber, night will be the water. You know, everything is going the same way. And that is the biggest problem.
One of the other areas of the that was really powerful for me in terms of what's going on in the news today, and I wanted to kind of jump into this, and when you had John Perkins in the film and he was talking about what exactly transpired in Iraq and the history of Iraq and how Saddam Hussein came to power, and I had never heard that story before. That was a big surprise. I mean, I knew that something happened in Iraq, but I didn't know the details. And he talked about this one of the other previous presidents of Iraq, who I think his name was Qasim. Can you just kind of go over what that story was? Because I think for the listeners to hear the story of what exactly happened in Iraq and who Saddam Hussein really was put in power by, I mean, that was an incredible story.
No, absolutely. The story, and you know, what is interesting is that it's a great story because it was in the news all over, as we know, but it's the same story that happened all around the world. You know, so the story was that, of course, Qasem was a very popular, you know, president elected by the people of Iraq. And, but he was very like, you know, like all these other leaders that we killed all around the world. He was a nationalist, which means that, you know, he wanted the resources of Iraq to go to the Iraqi people, number one. And of course, the number one resource was, of course, oil. You know, like Mossadegh in Iran, or like Chavez in Venezuela today. You know, and what happened is that, of course, that was totally unacceptable to the American companies and therefore to the American Congress and therefore to the American president, you know, and we put a higher assassin, like John Perkins explained, on the work to get rid of him, and that was Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was on the payroll of the CIA for a long time, you know, and he was sent to assassinate Qasem. And he failed, he was wounded, he had to leave the country, you know, and of course, so we send the other forces there, you know, to get Qasem publicly executed on the Iraqi television, you know, and put Saddam Hussein in power, of course, you know. So, you know, but that is an interesting story because you're right, very few people know about that, but it's the same story that happened with Mossadegh in Iran. I can tell you today we have the regime that we have in Iran because we remove forcefully, you know, and I can tell you the Iranian people, I spoke with a lot of Iranian people because we're involved in another movie with some of them, you know, they remember very well the story of Mossadegh. Mossadegh was their leader. He was elected by the Iranian people, and he was also a nationalist, like Nasser was in Egypt, or other people, or Ben Bella in Algeria. You know, and we remove all these people because it was much more convenient for us at the time to give money and to put in power this religious leader, because we thought that the religious leaders like the Ayatollah and so on didn't care about resources. They were very happy to let us use their resources as long as, you know, they could be in power and impose their religious regime. So it was very convenient for us at the time. It's why we financed the Mujahideen, you know, in Afghanistan. It's why we financed the Taliban. It's why we financed all these groups. You know, and everywhere in the world you arrive at exactly the same situation, which is, you know, because we are so desperate for these resources, we are ready to go to any length, you know, and any trick, any economic hitman trick, as John says, you know, in the film, you know, to put our hands on these resources. And if we failed through economic hitman and through a CIA agent, we are sometime, like in Iraq recently, ready to send the military. You know, like another expert explained in the film, you know, and that was like that forever. It didn't, you know, it started in the 50s with Mossadegh. That was probably the first economic hitman. You know, it was Kermit Roosevelt who was sent to remove Mossadegh from power, you know, and after it continued like that over and over. Every time that there was some corporate interest, like also other experts explained in the film, you know, when you had, for example, corporate interest of the United Fruit Company, you know, in South America, we would send the economic hitmen or the CIA or the military, like we did in all the countries there, you know. So that is that. It's true that it's about, you know, as you know, the movie opened like in 10 cities, pretty much in the U.S. And we have been doing like a lot of Q&As everywhere, and everybody has the same reaction. They say, "Oh my God, we had no idea that we were doing these kind of things." You know,
one of the aspects that came up in the movie was that our system, our current system of capitalism, cannot operate without free labor, and that's exactly what's happening all over the world. But there has been a change recently. In the colonial times, the slave owners, they took care of the shelter and the health concerns of their workers. And today, the so-called boss of people who work in these conditions, they don't have the concerns. They go outside of the city and they pick up their laborers in a truck and they bring them back to work. And at the end of the day, they drop them back off outside of, you know, outside of the city. And also today that people have work quotas. They don't even get paid unless they cut a certain amount of sugarcane or pick enough of whatever the crop is. And that's been a change from when you think about slavery, you know, hundreds of years ago to today. There's a lot of differences. And I wasn't aware of that particular distinction. When that was pointed out in the film by some of the people, of course, who you interviewed, that really brought it home to me to realize that these people are really, they're not only working for nothing, but they're completely on their own.
Not only they are on their own, as you explained, for everything, like, you know, at least at the, you know, during the you know, not that I'm defending the colonial time, that I'm attacking and explaining that it is responsible for most of the trouble that we are in today. You know, so I don't want to defend colonialism, of course, but it's true that at the time there was a sense of reciprocity between the slave and the owner. You know, and so because of the work that the slave provided to the owner was supposed to provide something in exchange, which was at least shelter and food. You know, now today there is no such concern. And as you know, as we went to interview the sugarcane cutters, and it was the same thing in Bolivia. You know, all the people who are used to do the harvest, you know, the harvest of nuts or whatever they have there. It's exactly the same situation, is that these people, you know, are not provided anything. And even sometimes, you know, we had this example in Bolivia, for example, people work in haciendas for only food and even shelter. They are kicked out at the end of the day or at the end of the harvest, you know, and put in the street. You know, so you have this totally new form of modern poverty, which is even, as you said, absolutely worse than during colonial time. I can tell you, during the time we were with the cane cutters in the region of Recife in Brazil, we were working with this great movement, you know, that had been working for the workers for a long time, called the Movimento Sem Terra, which is the landless people movement, you know, which has been working to, and you know, they are, as you saw, they are two leaders of the Movimento Sem Terra in the film. And, you know, and during the time we were there interviewing these guys, two of the leaders were shot you know, by the landowners, shot dead.
Wow.
By the landowners who are trying to get rid of these guys, of course, because what these guys do is not so much to provide better condition or this and that. They are just trying to get the land which is left idle. It's not even the land that the big landowners use. It's the land which is left idle for speculation purposes. And they are trying to relocate these guys, which are landless and, of course, who have nothing, you know, on this idle land. And, of course, for the landowners, it's absolutely unacceptable. And they are ready to shoot this guy one after the other. You know, so yes, you're absolutely right. There is this modern form of slavery, which is, it's true. It's worse than during colonial time. So again, doesn't make colonial time better, but it is, you know, we are in a situation, these people are in a situation. And again, the worst part is that they are in a situation because of us, because we are rich and because we need these resources. That was the worst part to see in the film. It was not so much to see the suffering, of course, it was very hard to witness that, but to feel that we were entirely responsible for that was even worse, you know.
Well, one of the things that was a big change that I also was pointed out in the film, when the indigenous cultures were here and they were supporting themselves before the Europeans got here, and still, even to this day, in many parts of the world, people learned to support themselves. They had their own agriculture. They had their own industries. They had their own crafts. They made their own tools. When this situation started with this aspect of colonialism, what happened that I kind of perceive is that agriculture became separated from industry, and that thus that prevented the farmers from, first of all, making their own tools, and then it transformed them into what you call commodity buyers. So all their existing industries and ways of life that they had were destroyed, and the colonies forced them to buy manufactured goods from their colonial masters. And so that is how the people who had not only just their livelihood, but their entire way of life, and then even the spiritual aspects of their lives were taken away from them, or they were imposed upon by people carrying, you know, whatever religion that they had. And so the colonizers, and you pointed this out in the movie also, the colonizers introduced the concept of superiority in terms of race and culture through religion. I really got exactly what happened in terms of the historical context when you made that point, because it put everything into perspective that's been happening over history in the last several hundred years. Can you comment a little bit about those two aspects?
Yeah, I think that was for me one of the most important aspects in the film, because that is something that really nobody knows, is that, you know, everybody thinks, well, you know, we had this very violent, you know, conquistador and colonizers who did whatever they thought was right at the time, and, you know, and the consequences were what they were, but that's not what it was. You know, the reality is that we had, meaning our ancestor had, a very systematic approach to destroying the livelihood of these people. And they had, you know, like, for example, we give the example of the weavers in India, or the people who were doing potteries in Indonesia. And for example, the weavers in India were making much better product than the British could make at the time. But the British Empire destroyed systematically any weaving system, tool, whatever it is that they had, systematically for two reasons. The number one was, of course, to not have an industry which could compete with theirs. You know, and number two was to, you know, to create a market for their own product, you know. So, and that's what we did, like, all around the world. You know, the pottery of Indonesia, that was the same story. Doesn't matter where you take it. There were two goals, because, of course, because of the resources of the South that we stole, we were able to start industrial revolution and create industries in all the European countries. But this industry now needed a market. First of all, we needed to make sure that there would not be competition. So that's why we destroyed all the existing industries, you know, and on top of that, we needed to create a market for our own products. So that's what we did. So if you want, the concept was to prevent people from creating their tool, from growing their food, from making their own clothes, etc., etc., so they would have to buy everything. And as we point out also in the film, you know, we take them out of the, you know, the basic concept is that we take people away from their land and you make a poor person. As long as someone has a plot of land to grow their own food, of course they can be poor, but they will never be starving. The moment you remove them from their land, of course they have no way to provide for their family but to sell their workforce, and that you create a slave. And it's the same thing when you prevent them from, you know, from making their clothes, their tool, et cetera, et cetera. You force them to buy everything that they need, and of course in exchange, and of course because they have no resources to buy these things, you can exploit them the way you want. It's as simple as that. Yeah. And so that came together with, of course, the cultural and the religious aspect. Is that at the same time that we're imposing these kind of things on these people, you know, as you saw, you have all these people who explain that their religions were destroyed. They were forced to, of course, to embrace Catholicism in Spain or Protestantism elsewhere, you know. And to the point that we even destroyed their language. For example, you remember there is this leader, this Aymara leader in Bolivia, who explained that before they had their own language, which was written and verbal, you know, that we don't even know, you know, and which is totally gone, which doesn't exist anymore. Everything was destroyed. It was called the Quipus, as he explained, you know, and nobody can write or speak this language anymore. And, you know, it creates this loss of identity. You know, these people have no identity anymore. They don't know who they are anymore, etc. Because, of course, they can't really embrace, you know, religion. Or when they do, as you saw, for example, in the scene in the Cathedral of Sucre, you know, we were there during Christmas time, and the mass celebrated there, you know, was mainly, you know, the cathedral was full of what they call their mestizos, which are the mixed blood coming from, you know, Spanish ancestors and mixed with, you know, eventually, you know, Indian blood or even the pure, of course, Spanish descent, you know. But what was interesting is that all the old traditional, you know, indigenous people would still today sit on the ground and not on the benches in the church with everybody else, which tells you, I think, very clearly what the story was, you know, is that we destroyed their culture because that was the way to control them and, again, to keep access to these resources.
Well, let's stay a little bit in the country of Bolivia. Bolivia is... a very important part of the movie that I felt, because one of the other sequences in the film was about the riots that happened over water when I think the name of it was Bechtel, went in and they started privatizing water, where people actually had to pay for their water, and it was it created a massive riots in the street. People just really came out and tried to put a stop to this because it was really destroying livelihood and everything. Can you talk a little bit about that story, about what happened in the riots in Bolivia?
No, absolutely. That's why it was interesting, because what I tried to show is that, in fact, the system didn't change at all from the time of the conquistador. The only thing that we changed were the tools that we use to oppress these people. We are not using anymore the gun and the cannons on the boats. We are using economic tools. And like, for example, privatization, like the structural adjustment program of the IMF, the loans of the World Bank, as John Perkins explained, which are totally artificial and made in order to have access to these resources. We have, you know, the unfair trade, the unfair taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted to show the Bolivia, because it's a wonderful example. Bolivia became, as one of the experts says, the lab rat, you know, of extreme neoliberal policies. You know, all the Milton Friedman and all this, you know, the Reaganesque, you know, area, you know, Bolivia became the lab rat. Everything was privatized. Everything was put in the end of foreign corporation. And the last thing which was still not privatized was the water system. And it was like probably 7 years ago, something like that, you know, the Bolivian government went back. It was before Evo Morales' time. The Bolivian government went back to the World Bank and said, hey, we need an additional loan because, look, we can't pay for the existing loans, which is always the same, which is always a great concept, which are so much high interest rate, you know, for loans which are not even, you know, something used in the country, that they can't even pay, they default, and therefore they ask for more loan to pay the existing loan. And what happened is the World Bank said, absolutely, we'll give you this loan, but, you know, we need you to privatize your water system. And so the country was divided in three or four different areas, which were given, all each area was given to an international corporation like Suez, the French company, or Bechtel, you know, in the region of Cochabamba. And what happened, of course, on paper it looks good, because the concept is we will absolutely remodel the whole system, we will put brand new pipes and this and that all over the country, we'll bring water to everybody who doesn't have water. But the story story was totally different, is that Bechtel didn't do anything, zero, didn't modernize anything, didn't even pay for the rent in their building that they were renting when they moved in the country, or for the computers they were using. But suddenly they started to raise the water rate of everybody by twice or three times. People had to pay three times more than they were paying before. And they decided they would simply not accept that. That was unacceptable because on top of that, it was hurting a very traditional concept of, you know, of water belongs for all the Bolivian people to Pachamama, the Mother Earth. And that was hurting this tradition that nobody can own Mother Earth and nobody can own what belongs to Mother Earth. So they decided they would not accept that because, first of all, they could not pay, number one, and because it was hurting this great tradition. And they went in the street and they totally paralyzed the area of Cochabamba, you know, and they faced tanks and bullets and their governments and the dogs and the police. People were killed, but they decided they would not move until that situation stopped and come back to what it was before. Because the most absurd part of that is that the Bechtel and the World Bank forced the government to pass law which says that people would not even have the right to go fetch water in the river or would not even have the right to collect rainwater, which was, of course, beyond belief. But that was the law that was passed. And, of course, that was totally unacceptable, and people didn't move. They blocked all the region for, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks until the government had to give in and say to Bechtel, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do. We can kill them all. So, you know, so Bechtel had to leave the country. The most funny part is that Bechtel decided to sue the Bolivian government for damages. You know, and which was kind of amazing, of course, very interesting, because, of course, for broken agreement, you know, and they realized when Morales was elected the first time that it would never go anywhere, so that they had to let go. But that was even their, it was even a great idea for them. It was even a great situation. They would do nothing, invest nothing, and but still get like hundreds of millions of damages that they wanted. You know, so that's what the extreme capitalism is, the way it works in these countries. And but the good part also is to see that even in front of guns and bullets, etc., the people united and which decided to not let that go, they won. Bechtel had to leave the country, and now the people, the Bolivian water is back in the hands of the Bolivian people.
Well, you talked about the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund basically playing the role of the economic police force for the rich nations to keep the poor nations in check. And the most important instrument of control has been international debt. The former colonial governments illegally saddled their former colonies with that debt when they departed, and that knowing that the combination of debt and economy based on raw materials exports would keep the former colonies in a state of independence. And through this debt and independence, the South finances the North. And that was really pointed out strongly in your movie. And basically what that does is it sends far more of its economic surplus to the northern banks than they receive in foreign aid. This wouldn't be so bad, but if the money that was put into the country, they go to build vanity projects, not the kind of infrastructure that really helps the poor, and all the poor get, they're left to paying off the debt. And that's all that they get out of this. Just like you mentioned, there's nothing that really happens in their country to help them. It's just they end up just owing money, and the money goes back into the hands of the North. So it's an unbelievable system, and you wonder, how did we ever get here? And in modern times, recently, I'm looking at more of this aspect of neoliberalism that really began during the Reagan administration, and you point that out as so many things changed during the Reagan administration. And we've talked about many movies that we had on this program, from the future of food, talking about pharmaceuticals, talking about all sorts of things. Really, there was a big shift that happened. When I saw your film, it put in perspective exactly how this happened and why it happened, because it had to do with global trade and global economy and this aspect of neoliberalism. Can you talk a little bit about what that term means?
And, you know, the worst part is that even if this debt were used, you know, it's why it was very important for me to have John Perkins in the film, because he's the first one who said, well, you know, all what you were doing was true, and here is what I did. that's not a theory, it's what I did, and I am responsible for that. And he explained, you know, all these debts are created. You know, what they do, meaning this engineering firm and this economic hitman like he was, go in a country, you know, they start to be, and of course, for everybody who didn't read Confession of an Economic Hitman, it's a wonderful read, you learn everything there. You know, they are sent to this country to build this great project. Like, for example, you go in a country and he says, oh, look, you know, we'll bring this $2 billion project, which will bring electricity to all this part of the country who has none. You know, and don't worry, the World Bank will loan you the $2 billion because it's clear that by bringing electricity, the GDP of this area will grow by, let's say, 20%, whatever the study is. You know, and with this growth, you will be able to repay the loan with no problem. But the trick is that everybody knows, not only the economic hitmen, but the World Bank specialist, and everybody knows that it's untrue, that the best growth that they will get because of bringing electricity is maybe 2%. And with this 2% growth, they will never be able to repay such debt. But that's exactly the goal, because we should never forget that the money that is given to the World Bank for this project is coming from the American taxpayers, among others. Right? So the money never goes to the country there. The money goes from the American taxpayer to the big corporation like the Halliburton and the Bechtel, which will build this big project. And the goal is that to make sure that this country defaults, because of course they will never see the 20% growth. So after a couple of years where it's clear they cannot repay the debt, you know, the economic hitmen return and say, hey, you could not pay your debt. Well, sorry, you defaulted, so now what we want your oil for free, we want your gas, we want this mineral, we want you to send troops there to help us in this part of the world, etc., etc. And that's how we enslave these countries, is by creating, you know, these fake loans. They are fake because, of course, they are based in totally false, you know, assessment, and everybody knows it's false, but that's all the goal. Because, again, before anything else, what we want is the resources of these countries. And again, we will do anything to get them, including military coup, of course. Because if we can get them through corruption or through this economic hitman trick, etc., etc., we will send the military, of course.
Well, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about your personal journey making this film. I always kind of ask those questions on this program. One of the things that I found reading some of the press materials about the movie is that you started off actually looking at both sides of the poverty debate, and you even filmed several experts who were proponents of progress in technology that will kind of solve everything, and that the film, as you were creating it, you kind of had a shift into the first the cut of the film, which is close to how it exists now in terms of the first edit, where you didn't use any of that. You threw all that out because the process of exactly what you wanted to say evolved for you. Can you talk a little bit about how this film evolved in terms of the structure of the story and what you were saying in it?
No, absolutely. You know, it's true that at the beginning I thought it would be interesting, you know, or to have the other side, to have them justify what they do and how they do it and why they do it. But, and we interviewed a lot of these people, you know, like Oponent, for example, of Evo Morales in Bolivia, or Lula in Brazil, and, you know, and all these kind of guys. And what they were saying were so pathetic that when I started to edit that, the only way that I could use what they were saying is by making fun of them, which was, for me, totally counterproductive because it doesn't bring anything, meaning it's more like the Michael Moore style, which I'm not really... meaning it's great. Michael knows how to do that wonderfully well, but it's not my type of things. But I can give you some examples. You will not believe it. Like, for example, of course, the traditional, you know, idea of these people is that if the poor are poor, it's their fault, meaning that, for example, they are not educated, so because they are not educated, they don't know what to do, and if they were educated, they would get themselves out of poverty, which is, of course, extremely racist and extremely wrong and beyond whatever. But that, we heard that from most of these guys. But, you know, for example, we went to interview the opponent of Evo Morales, who would like to come back in power. His name is Tuto Quiroga, and he was in power in the past. And, of course, he wants to come back. And, you know, Tuto Quiroga is someone who is a Harvard-educated, speaks better English than me, dressed like an American banker, and has an office which looks like an American banker. And when he welcomed us, he knew that we were making a movie on poverty. And during this hour-and-a-half interview we had with him, very courteous man and very nice man, he said, oh, you know, I could solve the problem of poverty without absolutely any problem. And I said, oh, wonderful. How would you do that? And he said, well, it's very simple. You know, I would do nothing because the market is so high right now. It means the market for commodities is so high for gas and other mineral they have that I would have to do nothing. The market would do it by itself. And I said, well, you know, unfortunately, we heard that and tried that for the last 50 years, it never worked. So, you know, but whatever. Let's say fine for a second. And I said, but so why it didn't work when you were in power? And he said, oh, it's very simple. It didn't work because the market was so low that there was nothing I could do. So I said, in fact, you are telling me that you don't do anything no matter what. Because if the market is very high, you don't do anything because, of course, it will supposedly do it by itself. And when it's very low, you don't do anything because there's nothing you can do. And that's exactly what he was trying to say. You know, and when you have this kind of, and I could tell you 100 stories like that, which are like, you know, it's the story of, you know, you give a fish to a poor person, it's good, but it's not good enough. If you teach him how to fish, it's better. And these are very extremely dangerous theories that we have heard over and over and over again, you know, because it simply means that the poor don't know how to fish, which is the most, of course, absurd, racist, anything you want, you know, discriminatory statement, which are, again, extremely dangerous because people believe these kind of things. You know, it's like when Mr. Jeffrey Sachs ran around the world with Bono and all these guys, you know, saying that if we bring mosquito nets and fertilizers to this country, it will solve poverty. And these kind of theories are extremely criminal because in the meantime, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are dying, you know, every week, you know, because of this kind of theory, because people believe that. They say, oh, yeah, these poor people are not educated. Let's teach them what we know, and they will be much better off, which is, of course, totally untrue. And that's also a thing that the movie is trying to fight, is this kind of absurd idea, you know, which are, you know, brought and maintained by these kind of people, you know.
Well, I also wanted to mention one of the other aspects that that you said in some of the notes in the press releases is that you decided to shoot the film in a way that it would really, so the viewer would get to know the person. You didn't use any camera tricks. You just filmed everything very straight. You used natural lighting. So you didn't do anything, you know, fancy about it because you really wanted to fit the style of the film into the content of the film. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to that decision?
Well, yeah, there was two aspects of that. The first one is that, you know, the subject is so dramatic. And what I wanted, first of all, is to avoid any kind of miserabilis, you know, images like, you know, where you see people starving to death, like we see on TV all the time when, you know, this kind of organization try to raise money and this and that. And I think that doesn't help anything. So what I wanted to let, you know, the poor people really express themselves about their life and tell us what's going on and show us what's going on. And so I thought that that is so dramatic by itself that I cannot use any kind of cinema imagery or sound or effects or editing. Like, you know, if I start to make, you know, editing like MTV style, you know, that would be totally unacceptable to me, number one. And number two, I thought I should differentiate, you know, between the poor people and the expert, because the experts, you know, even if they are very interesting people and who have a lot of things to say, they are usually comfortably, you know, seated in their office or in their apartment or whatever it is. And so I shot them like with three or four lights, with even color gels, to make them look good and this and that. And I thought in the meantime we have to see the reality they are describing as it is. So it's why I decided, for example, to not use any kind of light whatsoever when I was shooting the poor people, to shoot them in their environment. So it's why I shot the people, you know, when they were in their house, even if it was a 5 feet by 5 feet room with no light whatsoever. I shot without light. All the poor are shot handheld camera because that's what their situation is. They have nothing, you know. I shot the sugarcane worker in the fields and all the people wherever they were, you know, and that was important because I think we have to realize that there is a major difference between making theory about poverty and living poverty. You know, like, you know, and all the people, what was very interesting, and that's why I wanted to show also, is all these poor people, none of them are passive and crying on their situation. It's not that they say, oh my God, we're poor, there's nothing we can do, you know, and we'll just wait and whatever. No, they are all extremely active and they all fight and they all create programs and things to help each other. And that was very, very impressive. And that's what I wanted to show as well.
Yes, I mentioned that earlier when I was talking to to Beth about how noble these people that you captured on camera seem to be. They're, you know, like you said, you didn't shoot the people suffering in the streets kind of a thing and, you know, flies on their faces or something like that. You really show these people in a very, very different light. We got to know them. We got to see their humanity. We got to see the struggles that they have. And I really like that about the film. And it's a very rare does anyone who lives in this, you know, comfortable Western culture get to see people who are living in incredibly awful conditions in that light. And just how amazing the noble humanity that exists all over the world. And I thank you for showing us that, because that really spoke to me very strongly in the movie. There's a gentleman named Clifford Cobb, and who talked a little bit about some of the solutions at the end of the film. One of these things that has to do with some few specific policy changes that may at least be a beginning to start to end poverty. And some of those, as you list them, are canceling debts, creating fair trade agreements, imposing taxes on wealth and not consumption of necessities, and the privatization of natural resources, developing land reform that shares land or its value among the actual producers of farm products, and initiate programs of degrowth in the North to reduce wasteful consumption, which is what all the whole green movement is about. Can you talk about some of these solutions that are at least being discussed by some of the economists or people globally that have at least begin to make some sort of a start toward doing something about this situation?
I did a lot of Q&As with Cliff Cobb, you know, because he came with us to talk about that in many, many cities, like in Los Angeles, and he's in Portland right now. And, you know, what he says all the time, because you have always a lot of activists in the room who says, well, what can I do? It's an unbearable situation. What can I do? And his answer is always the same. He says, well, first of all, you have to stop about thinking, what can I do? Because I will not be able to do anything. We have to stop thinking about what can we do. And why? Because it is clear that the politician will never do anything to relieve the poor. The politician will never help the poor because it's not in their interest. So we know that. We have seen that for hundreds of years. So unless we create like very strong group who have like a million members or 5 million or 10 million members and we push on this politician to change things, nothing will ever happen. So that's what he says. He said, number one is to think as we. And of course, after there are a lot of political solutions that we could try to force our government and our politicians to do, like a lot of countries in the South are starting to implement, for example, stopping the monopoly of natural resources, you know, and canceling this privatization, which are totally illegal, of course. Why would the water, the oil, or any other natural resources of a country be owned by a foreign corporation? That's an absurd concept. You know, so, of course, we have to end that. And again, a lot of countries in South America specifically are going back to that. I can give you just one example. I'm not sure I remember exactly the numbers, but I believe that before that Evo Morales started his redrafting of the agreement with the oil company, the split between the oil company and the Bolivian government in terms of the profit of the oil pumped out, or it was gas actually, gas pumped out of Bolivia, was 1815 in 18 of sorry 85-15, 85% going in the pocket of the oil company and 15% going in the pocket of the Bolivian government. And when Evo Morales and his vice president Garcia Linera, that we interview in the film, when came in power, they say, well, guess what, we'll reverse that. Now you'll get the 15% and we'll get the 85 or something close to that. And of course the oil company said, oh, you know, yeah, you're very funny people, we'll all leave and you will be left by yourself to exploit your oil that you won't be able to do, so you will have nothing. And they'll say, okay, we'll take the risk and try that. Well, guess what? The oil company are still there and they are pumping the gas and they are making 15% today. You know, so there are a lot of things which are implemented like that and which are very important. Agrarian reform, of course, even if he's a very moderate, unfortunately, much more moderate than we thought he would be. President Lula had been working very hard to to promote agrarian reform, giving back the land. And it's not so much the problem of the agro business, of course, is a major problem, as we know. But the worst problem in this country is the land which are left idle for speculation purposes. That's even the worst problem. And there are a lot of the arable land who are left idle. So that has to be implemented, of course. The tax justice, you know, the tax system was before, you know, the taxes were falling on property ownership, property of all kind, of course, land, but also resources and this and that. And little by little, because of the neoliberal policy, it shifted without everybody even noticing, less and less on property and more on labor and consumption, which is absolutely scandalous, of course. And it's why, you know, Milton Friedman and all these guys in the School of Chicago is an absolute fraud, of course, because, you know, it means simply that the poor are financing the rich. As simple as it is, you know, so that should be implemented as well. We should change, of course, this totally unfair trade that we impose in the countries of the South, you know, etc. So there are a lot of policy which can be implemented, but they need our help, because it's clear that unless we change first our level of, you know, of destruction and our level of, you know, of consumption of their resources, you know, they will never be able to implement anything. And it's why we arrive at the last but not least, you know, idea, which is, it's not an idea, it's something which has been also started to create a real movement in Europe and also in the United States in some parts, is this concept of degrowth. Because our system was based from the beginning on growth for the principle of growth. You know, it's great to grow when you are underdeveloped, but when you are overdeveloped, as we are, to grow is absurd. You know, because again, it's taking the resources from people who needed to grow. You know, and so the story is that, you know, unless we degrow, and, you know, they will never be able to grow. And, of course, it will create more terrorism and more violence and this and that. You know, so degrow is not necessarily drive less and eat less. It's working less. You know, so, for example, if we work 5 hours a day, it means that we have 7 hours to do something else. So, of course, we will consume less naturally, but maybe also we'll consume better because we'll be able to grow our own food, to use food which is locally grown rather than internationally shipped, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so all these things are, of course, important, and the whole concept of the film is that we want to throw these ideas for people to discuss them and think about them and work with them.
Well, Philippe, thanks so much for that kind of a long answer. I really appreciate you explaining completely so people really understand some of the things that will need to be done and will need to be looked at in this time of dealing with this situation, because the solutions have to go much deeper than any set of specific policies. The process of overcoming 500 years of oppression on a global scale cannot be reversed without a deep transformation of institutions. So that's going to be something that we're all going to have to work, as you say, all together. So, Philippe, thanks so much for being on the program today. I really appreciate it. We're about at the close here. Hope you enjoy your day over there in France.
So now I'm going to go to bed soon, I have to tell you. But thank you for having me. It was great.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Okay, me too. Bye.
Well, everyone, that's a wrap for our show for this week. Join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. I'd like to thank our engineers today for everything that they do in making the show work, and the Catfish Groove Farm Band for our theme music. You can hear more of their cool tunes at catfishgroovefarm.com. And please tell your friends about where to find our program right here on seventhwavenetwork.com. And don't forget about spiritoffilm.net as well for everything about my show. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Abaro for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.
Again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit seventhwavenetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the